A downtown street collapse in Jacksonville brings renewed concern about this area's roads and bridges. We'll take your calls just ahead. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. First Coast Connect, always live on the radio. And now, if you miss a show, just catch our daily podcast on iTunes. Just ahead, we'll take your calls as President Obama calls for more spending on the nation's infrastructure. Republicans in Congress say it's not a doable plan. We want your calls now, 549-2937. Then later, marking Heart Month with Go Red for Women. Plus, the late Stetson Kennedy remembered this weekend at a special Ritz Theater performance. All of that ahead. But first this morning, still lots of concern around town about safety after the weekend collapse of part of Liberty Street in downtown Jacksonville. City officials have closed the parking lot behind the former Duval County Courthouse, and two neighboring streets are also closed while they investigate. That section of Liberty is right over the St. Johns River, so it's under the jurisdiction of the Florida Department of Transportation, which oversees the state's bridges. DOT spokesman Ron Tittle says it's probably not safe to send divers into the river to inspect that wreckage.
Since the concrete, the slabs are a little bit unstable, it seems. So now the assessment is whether to use cameras to try to go in and inspect up under where the collapse structure is, or whether to bring maybe a barge in to lift the slabs up.
The state's bridges are inspected by FDOT every 2 years. And amid growing concern over the nation's crumbling roads and bridges, President Obama this week in his proposed budget says he'd like to spend nearly $500 billion in transportation and construction spending. The president seeking to upgrade the nation's roads, bridges, and ports by imposing new taxes on overseas earnings by American companies. This six-year, $478 billion infrastructure plan would provide about a 30% increase in funding for big new public works projects. But even though there is bipartisan agreement on the need to fix our aging bridges and roads, the president's plan is facing an uphill battle in Congress because of the way he'd like to pay for it. So, this morning, we're beginning the hour with a closer look at American infrastructure issues and how we should deal with them. Here in studio, we're pleased to welcome Rick Mullaney, director of JU's Public Policy Institute. Rick, good morning.
Good morning.
And also with us, A.G. Gankarski, writer with Folio Weekly and Florida Politics.
Good morning.
Just published a piece about this, and we want your calls right now. We're already getting your calls. Let us know what you think should be done to shore up the nation's roads, bridges, and ports. Give us a call. 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. We also welcome your comments. We already have plenty of them on our Facebook page. Rick Mullaney, let's begin with you. As a guy who spent some time at Jacksonville City Hall, this is certainly not anything that's welcome news for city officials or state officials as they try to investigate how this collapse occurred.
Yeah, I think the collapse is actually a piece of a much bigger question, and that is investment in infrastructure locally. You saw a very major initiative to fund infrastructure investment with the Better Jacksonville Plan, a $2.2 billion investment. That half-cent sales tax was dedicated to infrastructure investment, lots of roads, $1.5 billion of it. And it generated about $65 million a year in revenue to help fund it. So the first order of business for local, state, and federal government in providing infrastructure is to get your financial house in order so you can fund it. And I think most would agree, Republicans and Democrats, that infrastructure is right in the wheelhouse of what you're looking for from your local government, your state government, your federal government. You're looking for roads, bridges, and ports to be properly funded, not only because they put people to work when they're doing it, because it's great for economic development and quality of life.
549-2937 to join the show. A.G. Gankarski, unfortunately, the Liberty Street collapse is one example of collapses and problems we've seen across the country. Americans' infrastructure is crumbling.
Right. I mean, this is something that I've been looking at for at least a decade. I wrote an editorial for the Washington Times in 2005 about our nation's infrastructure. And back then, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was proposing things like impact-based usage fees based on the weight of vehicles and so on. And that didn't actually happen. So people have been trying to figure out a way to pay for this for a long time. And, you know, in our political climate where, you know, you have Republicans, Democrats both talking about austerity on the local level, there hasn't been really much noise made about it. And, you know, we hear about it whenever we get a crisis situation like this. But Once the crisis abates, the issue is moved back to the periphery.
549-2937. Let us know how you think the nation should pay for fixing up our roads and bridges. This in the wake of the Liberty Street collapse in downtown Jacksonville. Rick Mullaney, two questions for you. One, our infrastructure needs have been put on the back burner, as AG said, for a number of reasons. Also, because the city's trying to deal with its pension debt. And then also, how do you see the politics of this at the national level? As President Obama says, let's tax companies on their overseas earnings to pay for this. Republicans on Capitol Hill say that's a non-starter with them.
Well, two pieces. First, the local piece you mentioned on funding local infrastructure. What you've seen in the pension crisis, quite frankly, in recent years has crowded out fundamental investment infrastructure. In the police and fire pension fund alone from 2003, an increase of about $10 million a year to today, $150 million a year. Think of that $140 million a year difference when the Better Jacksonville plan raised simply $65 million a year. That, in effect, is two Better Jacksonville plans worth of infrastructure investment that you're seeing crowded out. Mm-hmm. And I think most would agree that this is the number one challenge facing us locally in terms of our budget, getting our financial house in order, and very much related to infrastructure investment. So on that question, and I think the city's working very hard, the mayor's office, city council, the entire community on this problem, but it is very consequential, and it's consequential for infrastructure in the future of the city. On the national level, the idea of taxing corporate profits is, again, one piece of a much bigger picture. There's a big discussion about corporate tax reform, about potentially lowering the 35% rate, which is, quite frankly, high compared to the rest of the world, and part of the reason why you're seeing a lot of profits going abroad. And so I think what you're going to see, I actually think that the president and Republicans will get together to begin a discussion about how to address this issue on some potentially more comprehensive corporate tax reform. This is sort of the opening salvo of some political posturing for the future, because clearly you'll get a little bit of a chilly reception from the Republican Congress on this.
Right. AG.
Yes, actually, he's gotten a bipartisan chilly reaction. I believe it was Barbara Boxer and Rand Paul both are agitating against it.
It's not often they're on the same page.
Right. And it kind of shows the headwinds against sort of economic populism. And we saw in the State of the Union where President Obama has sounded protectionist themes, economic nationalist themes, sort of something we haven't heard in the last quarter century in this country. And I don't know if the political discourse is quite ready for it. So it's going to be an interesting time for him.
But as you pointed out, though, when there's a crisis, when a major bridge collapses and people get injured or killed, that's when constituents will demand that something be done. And we have had some major bridge collapses in recent years.
Yes, we have. And I believe it was Rahm Emanuel who said, never let a crisis go to waste. And that comes to mind. It's, you know, politicians who want to see infrastructure advancements need to actually speak to these crises and speak to remedies for these crises. And that's something that I believe President Obama is doing. And I think people on the local level, if they're smart, will actually take up this theme, because it's something that resonates not just in Jacksonville, not just in Northeast Florida, but across the country.
Yeah, as you said, Rick, everybody's got to use roads and bridges. Everybody has a stake, wherever your political views are. Everyone has a stake in them being safe and reliable.
Not just that. Yeah, absolutely so. But let me just say this, too. It's really bad public policy when you begin to ignore these needs and the cost grows and the safety issue grows. But there's another aspect of it, is you're putting your community out of position to succeed. If you want to position your community for economic growth, if you want to position your community for a better quality of life, both locally, statewide, and nationally, then infrastructure investments are critical. And you have to position yourself in order to do that. You can't wait till the time you need it. One of the things about the Better Jacksonville plan that I liked a lot is that it represented long-term thinking. Long-term thinking about the future needs of your community, what you wanted to become. And for the port right now, the city has to give some thought about positioning itself financially if it wants to go forward with its part of a very substantial infrastructure investment at the port. And there appears to be some support at the state level, the state budget being in a much better position right now than we are locally.
Lots of calls. Meanwhile, did you hear about the Liberty Street collapse downtown over the weekend? Luckily, nobody was seriously hurt. But that happened just as there's a debate in Congress over How to Pay for the Nation's Crumbling Infrastructure. President Obama wants to spend billions on shoring up America's roads, bridges, and ports. He'd pay for this in part by taxing corporations' foreign profits. That is the controversy. There is not agreement on that method of paying for this. How do you think America should deal with infrastructure? What are your thoughts? What are your concerns? Let's go to your calls right now at 549-2937. Jay is in Tampa calling in today. Hey, Jay. Good morning.
Good morning. This is Jay, formerly of Springfield, now living in Tampa. But
oh, okay.
Online.
Oh, very nice.
But I would say this. We get the country we pay for, just like if our home is falling apart, you know, we don't just say, oh, the plumbing's leaking, let me turn off the water. And that's so much what we're doing. And the GOP said that they would not do anything to see our president be successful. And that kind of thinking has trickled down from the national level all the way to the local level, where we have an opportunity to finally end this pension fiasco, and Clay Yarborough decides that he's going to push it off the agenda so it doesn't get done, and they can't move on to something more important, like how are we going to fix our crumbling infrastructure. So this is about going to the ballot in some means, that we have to start voting for people who see our infrastructure as a priority, and we just have to be adults about it and say, we're going to pay for it.
That's Jay calling from Tampa. AG, then, Rick, your thoughts.
Caller makes some good points. Regarding the pension plan, the mayor's office has had a hard time messaging that, conveying the actual plan. I saw Chris Hand on Twitter talking to Nate Monroe yesterday about it.
Chris Hand, the mayor's chief of staff.
Exactly. And, you know, coming back to what Rick said about the Better Jacksonville plan, that was kind of the perfect storm. Delaney was as popular as any mayor in Jacksonville history. He has as much political capital as anybody in general history. The next two mayors, we haven't really seen that. We didn't see it with Peyton. We haven't really seen it with Alvin Brown. So it takes not just vision, but it also takes a sort of bipartisan credibility and investment that, you know, maybe happens once in a generation.
Rick?
Well, I think the caller's first point was right, which is it's kind of like your home. You can't ignore it. If you ignore the maintenance and the needs, then you pay a bigger price later. And really, that simple principle applies to local, state, and federal government. Ignoring your infrastructure needs, there will come a time when you pay for that. His other points, however, is in order to accomplish this properly, you really do need to get your financial house in order. At the state level, we're very fortunate. We actually now have some surpluses, and you're seeing some pretty significant infrastructure investments at the state level. The national level, you've got $18 trillion in debt. At the local level, we have a pension crisis. So part of the public policy challenge is to get the city's financial house in order. During the Delaney years, he felt that the operating budget was in good shape. The economy was a little bit better back then, and he was able to make the case for a half-cent dedicated sales tax for infrastructure investment. Currently, I think if we can get the city's financial house in order, including the operating budget, which, by the way, in itself, 2 years ago we had to balance it with a tax increase. Last year we had to balance it by going into reserves. So there's a lot of work to be done locally to get the city's finances right. And when we do, we'll be in position, of course, to make these critical investments.
549-2937, Mark on the West Side. Go ahead, Mark.
Good morning. Two quick things. May I respectfully suggest that when Rick Mullaney dies, and hopefully many decades in the future, that he, on his tombstone, he puts Better Jacksonville plan. He's only mentioned it 40 times in the last 10 minutes. But my question is, why don't we just, right now, gas prices are at their lowest they've been since I can even remember. You know, we all use infrastructure, everybody who buys gas. Wouldn't this be a perfect time to slip, I mean, what, 2 cents, 5 cents a gallon? It couldn't be much if everybody's buying a gallon, you know? You know, 2 or 5 cents a gallon, we'd have 10 times that money inside a year or two. I can't imagine this isn't, you know, we wouldn't have to tax businesses any more than we already do. Like, you know, everybody would be getting on board with this.
That's Mark on the West Side. Here's a tweet from another listener. It's time to raise the gas tax 20 cents a gallon, 20 cents a gallon to pay for infrastructure. AG.
Well, if we raise the gas prices, that would, you know, bring them in line with the rest of the world. The rest of the world taxes gasoline very heavily. But, you know, talking about current gasoline prices, they're artificially low, and it's because the Saudis are, you know, flooding the market right now.
And they're
now.
Not going to stay low.
No, they've said it. You know, it's basically a play against Russia, and it's a, you know, sort of a limited time kind of thing. So, you know, counting on $2 a gallon gas for much longer is folly, in my opinion. You know, that said, a discussion about increasing gas taxes, it's a relevant discussion. It's something that, you know, gas taxes vary from place to place, as we know. And it's something that, you know, state politicians, local politicians, they could have that discussion. It's just one that comes at political risk.
And let's discuss what Barack Obama is proposing. He wants to impose a new one-time 14% tax on the nearly $2 trillion of foreign earnings that are not immediately taxed. They're held overseas by companies such as Apple, Microsoft, many other major American corporations. The White House says this would raise about $238 billion in one-time revenues to finance a new transportation trust fund. Rick Mullaney, what are your thoughts about that proposal?
Well, first of all, you may have noticed, tying this back to Mark's comment about the gas tax, the other half comes from the gas tax. He is correct. The national gas tax is designed to pay for national infrastructure, and a part of the president's initiative funding will come from the gas tax. This is the foreign tax piece.
Right.
One other piece is just last summer, the summer before last, city council actually extended Jacksonville's local option gas tax. And that in itself, just the extension of that gas tax back when gas prices were $3.40 or $3.50 mm-hmm. a gallon. So Jacksonville does have that piece, and mm-hmm. that goes to the
And there was some debate over that,
too. There was opposition then. I think politically increasing it is very problematic. Extending it was a battle itself. And so Mark's point on the gas tax as a funding source is one that is well considered nationally and locally. On the foreign profits, as I mentioned earlier, I think you're going to see some resistance to having simply one piece of this discussion. There's a whole corporate tax rate structure discussion and corporate profits discussion that's going to go on with the corporate tax rate, as I mentioned earlier, 35%. And so I think as AG mentioned earlier, it has gotten a bit of a chilly reception. But I do think there's the opportunity. George Bush did something like this during his first term at a much lower number in which he tried to bring back corporate profits back into the country with a lower one-time fee. So there may be a possibility of working out some compromise if mm-hmm. it's part of a bigger reform package.
Do you agree?
Yes, I think it's possible. It's just a question of how much political capital does President Obama have. You know, he's obviously lame duck. He's never running again. And he's made that very clear. So, you know, it's just a question of, you know, how much can he actually convince people, especially across the aisle, to adopt his proposals?
Let's go to Joe, who is calling from downtown Jacksonville. Hey, Joe, how are you?
Good. I'm very good. How are you doing?
Doing great, thanks. Go ahead.
Well, one of the issues I think that we have that we're, and I haven't been listening to the whole program this morning, so I may be repeating somebody else's issues, but right there where that Liberty Street collapsed is where the brand new Berkman Plaza is.
Uh-huh.
Matter of fact, a lot of those homes that Berkman built there lost their power, probably still out of power. But if you take a look at the deal that we gave this corporation when they came in here and built that thing, they bought that property for almost nothing. Probably don't have any impact fees on it. And I think they got like a 10-year stay on any kind of taxes they were paying on it. This is what's happening in America today. Corporate America has bought our politicians, and our politicians are doing their bidding for them, and they're putting all of these costs on the individual taxpayers, the homeowners. Corporate America is not paying any taxes. And you go right down Liberty Street, my business is on Liberty Street.
What's your business?
I'm with the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers.
Okay. So is that office closed now?
It's electricians union.
Is that office closed now due to the collapse?
No, it is not. No, we're on the other side of, we're far enough away from that where it's not affecting our business. But if you drive down Liberty Street from where that problem is, you go right down Liberty Street to Evergreen Cemetery, there's huge potholes all over Liberty Street. So, you know, all the new homes that have been built down there and the businesses that have been established at Liberty Street, are they paying their fair share to keep that street up, keep business coming to them? I don't know.
All right. And that's Joe calling from downtown. Thanks for the call, Joe. Taking us back to when that Berkman Plaza project went in some years ago.
Right. And they obviously got a good deal to get it done. You know, he makes good points. And it comes back to the larger issue. We've done so much investment outside of downtown that we perhaps have neglected downtown infrastructure. And Delivery Street potholes and the collapse is just one symptom of it. We see it all over the downtown area, all over the east side, and it's something that needs to be addressed sooner than later.
Well, and the whole point, Rick Mullaney, of the Downtown Investment Authority is to try to bring some of those dollars back to the urban core.
Yeah, absolutely so. And I think the caller helps illustrate a difference between aging infrastructure, which is one problem, which is ongoing locally, state, and national, and maybe faulty construction issues that may be related to Berkman. But there is no doubt that we have some aging infrastructure in Jacksonville, the downtown core. The investment authority, as you've talked about, is trying to bring some of that investment into the downtown core. And those investments will have to address both aging infrastructure and the need for new infrastructure.
Lots of comments, meanwhile, on our First Coast Connect Facebook page as we talk about the Liberty Street collapse in downtown Jacksonville, just as President Obama says he wants to tax foreign profits from American corporations to pay for infrastructure investment. And opinions all over the map on our Facebook page. Doug writes, infrastructure investment is just that, investment, and it creates jobs. I'm in. Meanwhile, Matt writes, are these the same shovel-ready jobs promised way back in the 2008 campaign that failed to materialize with the so-called stimulus package? This shtick is beyond old. Learn a new trick. And let's see what else. Another Matt. Any country with infrastructure comparable to America has high taxes to pay for it. It's the cost of doing business. Where you're more likely to succeed, we need to pay our infrastructure bill. And then one more comment. Taxing companies and inflation are the reasons these American companies are moving their headquarters overseas. I don't think companies will want to bring dollars back to the states if we tax them for doing so. You agree with that?
Well,
AG.
I agree with some parts of it. Companies are obviously going to resist it. But, as part of leadership on a national level is to, make these cases. I mean, if a company is American-based, it follows they should want to invest in America. I mean, we get this idea of multinational corporations, but, if we're talking about a quote-unquote American corporation, then, there is a responsibility, I believe, to give a little bit back.
And some companies, Rick, have faced backlash. For example, I think the parent company of Walgreens had to backpedal off plans to headquarter itself overseas recently because that... consumers didn't like that.
No, I think a lot of this goes back for the need, as some are talking about this in Washington, for the need of a comprehensive look and where you and how you do this in the marketplace. Expecting companies to do this out of altruism or to invest is one thing. Setting up a tax code that looks at incentives, that makes it in the company's best interest to have profits here, that makes it in the company's best interest to have their businesses here, is really what I think the conversation is going to go towards. And in that case, you'll be able to take some of those foreign profits and bring those profits within the territorial limits of the United States, which is what many would like to see.
And it's 549-2937 to join the show. Bill calling from downtown. Hi, Bill. Good morning.
Yes. Well, they took a couple of questions away from me, but yes, that $700 billion stimulus on the shovel-ready jobs, I was wondering about that, but that, I don't think that ever materialized. But that had a real simple question, because I know when you build a piece of real estate, the day you put the shovel in the ground, from the moment the first rents come in, you reserve a piece of that for forever until the first capital cost comes from the bidding or structure you're doing. What mechanism is in place in municipalities across the country and federal government that does that? Do you build a bridge and then you just wait 50 years and when it collapses, you raise all the money then? Is that how it goes? I'm not sure.
Oh, God. And Bill, you're making me nervous just talking that way. I try to always keep my opinions out of these discussions, but, Rick Mullaney, you work on the JU campus, and anytime I head across the Matthews Bridge to that side of town, I think about that bridge. It's 60 years old, the Matthews Bridge.
Well, Bill makes some really good points. I think this isn't a problem just for government. This is a problem at nonprofits and at private corporations, too. But unfortunately, from a public policy standpoint, and you see this at the local, state, and federal level, is you worry about getting the capital to build what it is, and as Bill mentions, then you wait for it to collapse. And the failure in some public policy is to plan for both the maintenance costs, the operating expense, and sort of what you're going to do in the future to replace it. And the Matthews Bridge is one good illustration of that. But you can find lots of illustrations of that.
In fact, you did, as you investigated around the state, A.G. Gankarski.
Yes, I mean, there are plenty of examples in Duval County, Clay County, and so on. One thing that I talked to Dave DeCamp last night, and we talked about
the spokesman for the mayor.
Right. Thank you. And
just in case people didn't know who that was.
And Dave told me something interesting. DOT looked at the bridge 18 months ago. And
the Matthews you're talking about?
No, the Liberty Street.
Liberty
span.
Street.
And basically, it was deficient but not obsolete. So it was, you know, it wasn't in the worst category. And we talked about it last time we talked about infrastructure in a show, the various categories. And obsolete is obviously the worst. Deficient is.
So if something's rated deficient, it won't get immediate attention. Is that the basis of this?
Exactly. That's what happened. You know, there was a bridge in Clay County recently that was deemed obsolete and it got attention. So it really is a question of rating and a question of how subjective those ratings actually are.
Let's take one more call. It's Stan on the north side. Hi, Stan. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Melissa. How are you doing today?
Doing great, thanks.
As far as the gas tax, I think we're going more toward a mileage tax here with all the battery-operated cars. And one other statement, Reagan had trickle-down, and with this $4 trillion that they're talking about till 2016 that Obama is talking about, that's $2 trillion spent partially on rebuilding. And let me tell you, I was 30 years in the trades, okay, electrician, and things break down. So there has to be some balance in there. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's Stan on the north side. Thanks for the call, Stan. Rick Mullaney, let's close with you. The White House saying it's hopeful a compromise can be reached on business taxes. What are your final thoughts about that?
I hope so. I hope that you're going to see the Republicans and Democrats come together to talk about a comprehensive approach to some tax reform, particularly in the corporate tax arena. But this is just one piece of the discussion. By the way, that $4 trillion budget, a lot of that is you're looking at $2.3 to $2.5 trillion in Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, another $600 billion in military. And so it's really not that much in terms of some of it affected by sequester and the remaining piece, the military and the domestic programs. So it's a daunting challenge. I truly hope that in Congress and the White House, they can get together and come up with something that makes sense for both infrastructure investment and the overall budget.
Fascinating to speak with you both. Thanks for providing your thoughts this morning. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We were joined by Rick Mullaney, director of JU's Public Policy Institute, and columnist A.G. Gankarski this morning, discussing the nation's infrastructure issues and how to pay for them. And later, the words of the late Stetson Kennedy coming alive on the Ritz Theater stage will tell you about a special performance. But up next, how wearing red this week promotes heart health for women. That's next.
It doesn't get a lot of credit in the parenting world, but the ability to place things in categories is crucial to survival.
Look at their clock. What's that? Coffee pot. What do I do with it?
But sometimes, this impulse to categorize the world around you can make you do remarkably strange things. The Power of Categories on the next Invisibilia.
From NPR.
Sundays at 1 on 89.9 WJCT.
From the moment you wake up, through the chaos of your busy morning, Morning Edition is there with you.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Protesters have been
through marching. All you have to do, we'll bring you all you need to know tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Weekday mornings starting at 5 on 89.9.
Sex is pleasurable because of our sense of touch. And bruises hurt because of our sense of touch. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about pleasure, pain, and the sense of touch with neuroscientist David Linden, author of Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
Welcome back. Well, February is Heart Month, an important time to raise awareness that heart disease and stroke kill 1 in 3 women in this country. Now, Go Red for Women is coming up this Friday, a day to wear red to promote heart health. Dr. Pamela Rama is a cardiologist with Baptist Health and also president of the American Heart Association Metro First Coast Board of Directors, and she's here to tell us about heart health this February. Dr. Rama, good morning.
Good morning.
And you've got some red on today.
Yes, I'm wearing red this whole week.
Let's talk about National Wear Red Day. It's Friday, February 6th, and it's gotten more and more popular over the years. What's the purpose of it?
It really is to raise awareness among women that heart disease is their number one health risk.
And people don't realize that. Even now, people still think maybe breast cancer is the number one killer of women.
Yes. I mean, but it's improved, though. I mean, in 1997, only 30% of women knew that heart disease was their number one killer. But now in 2007, 2010, you saw an increase in that to around 54%. Now we're up to 60%. So it's getting better.
That's right. And what's the good news is though, even though heart disease is the number one killer of women, and of course, plenty of men die too, due to cardiovascular disease. So much of it is preventable. There's a lot we can all do to better protect our hearts. And that's the whole purpose of Heart Month in February. Can you share with us some really easy ideas that people can adopt?
Well, the first thing that you have to do is you know your numbers. You need to know what your blood pressure is. You need to know what your healthy cholesterol and bad cholesterol is. You need to know if you're a diabetic. And exercising is very important, physical activity, obviously, not smoking and maintaining a good weight, and also eating a heart-healthy diet.
And that means, it sounds like basic common sense, but let's talk about what constitutes a heart-healthy diet.
Right. You know, we as cardiologists, we promote the Mediterranean diet, wherein you have a good mix of fruits and vegetables, and you have olive oil and grains. You just have to, the more colorful your plate is, the better it is for you.
Yeah. Less saturated fats, very important. And let's also, this is interesting and important to point out, the symptoms of a heart attack in a woman can be very different than that presenting in a man, and sometimes it can be even misdiagnosed. Isn't that right?
Right, even misdiagnosed by doctors. You know, typically people who are having heart attacks have a substernal or chest discomfort that occurs with exertion, goes away with rest. Unfortunately, there's a greater proportion of women who will have what we call atypical symptoms. Sometimes just feeling very fatigued can be a symptom that there's something wrong going on with the heart. So you have to be aware of your body. Shortness of breath can be a symptom of heart disease. The pain doesn't necessarily have to be in the chest. Sometimes it could be in the stomach, and that's why women think that it might be just reflux when in fact it is coronary artery disease.
Interesting. And I have to tell you, I was stunned when I had my lipid profile done recently, and I've always eaten a really healthy diet, and they told me my cholesterol was a little high and prescribed niacin.
Wow.
And I'm thinking to myself, I can't believe I have to take this. I thought I was doing everything right. And so that it's a reminder that as we get older, we really have to be careful with it.
You really need to know your numbers. But starting early, you know, in your 20s, you need to know what your cholesterol level is, because that's the impact. If you modify your lifestyle early on, you could really change your risk of developing cardiovascular disease up to 80%.
And how much of it is genetic versus lifestyle?
As far as cholesterol is concerned, around 60% of it is genetic. So,
yeah.
You know, some people who can eat the healthiest thing can have an elevated bad cholesterol and a very low good cholesterol. So as far as that's concerned, hypertension is also genetic. So when you have parents that have high blood pressure, you're more likely going to be hypertensive as well.
And so if you do have the genetic predisposition, eating healthy, exercising are all the more important.
Yes, and it could really modify your risk, future risk for developing cardiovascular disease.
And at what point do people in that situation need to take medication? That can be a factor too, can't it?
Right. As soon as we get, you know, we have guidelines as to when to treat people. Your ideal blood pressure should be less than 140 over 90, but the optimal blood pressure is 120 over 80. So if you're presenting to your physician with a high level of, your blood pressure is high, he or she may start you on blood pressure medications.
Now, there's a free heart health assessment online, My Life Check. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's you could check your cholesterol level and you put in your risk factors and you'll be able to tell what your risk for cardiovascular disease is.
And there's some free tools on there as well, correct?
Yes, there are some free tools there as well.
And again, it's Go Red for Women, and Friday is National Wear Red Day. If you're just tuning in, Dr. Rama says, wear your red on Friday. It's an easy way to be part of this.
Absolutely. And everyone looks good in red.
You and so do you, by the way. So you're going to wear red all week?
All week.
It's one of my favorite colors to wear. So I love it. Thank you so much for being with us. Again, it's Heart Month and Go Red for Women. And Wear Red on Friday, Dr. Pamela Rama, cardiologist at Baptist Health, president of the local board of directors of the American Heart Association. Thanks for raising awareness. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Melissa.
Still to come, the words of the late Stetson Kennedy coming to life on the Ritz Theater stage. You're listening to First Coast Connect. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Ray Hollister.
I'm Tom Braun.
And we're the guys from Deemable Tech.
Hey, if you've got a question about your computer, mobile phone, tablet, or the internet,
and who doesn't,
we're here to help.
Join us Thursdays during Morning Edition and All Things Considered here on WJCT.
And check out our podcast online at deemable.com.
That's deemable.com.
From Brahms to Bob Marley, join us for After Hours weeknights at 7, only on 89.9 FM. All songs considered, all styles played on 89.9 FM. Your community, your world, your music.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, negotiators from 12 countries are hammering out details of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What's inside the TPP? Prospects for getting the trade deal through Congress, and what it could mean for the U.S. economy.
Weekdays at 10, right after First Coast Connect on 89.9 FM WJCT.
Travel back in time with Radio Theater, Doo-Wop Revival, The Great American Songbook, and Juke Joint. Throwback Sunday, Sunday nights beginning at 7 on 89.9 WJCT. Looking forward to looking back.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, as we kick off Black History Month, the Ritz Theater is inviting you to catch a special performance this weekend, giving life to the late Stetson Kennedy's works. The famed North Florida author, folklorist, and civil rights icon served as director of ethnic studies for the Florida Division of the Federal Writers Project. His book, The Florida Slave, is a collection of the oral histories of ex-slaves living in Florida. Excerpts from that book will be performed at the Ritz, along with Kennedy's Palmetto Country, which related African-American lore gathered by Kennedy and anthropologist Zora Neale Hurston. Now, we have a special treat right now in studio as we're joined by Stetson's widow, Sandra Parks Kennedy. Good morning.
Good morning.
And also with us, Daryl Willey, Director of District and Community Partnerships at Teach for America. Good to see you, Daryl.
Great to see you.
And Tangela Floyd, Executive Director of Young Minds Building Success Charities. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
In a moment, Daryl and Tangela are going to do a spoken word performance for us, an excerpt of what theater goers will see. But first, Sandra, can you tell us about this? This is a Narratives on Stage that Stetson wrote, a Reader's Theater performance. This sounds pretty special.
It's so special, Melissa. I truly wish that Stetson had ever in his lifetime heard these words performed by African Americans. So for his family and for the foundation, this is just extraordinarily significant for us. And as you've said, during the 30s, during the Florida Writers Project, Stetson was served as their person to gather the folklore and these oral histories of aged slaves. The office was down in the Dial-Up Church building, but this project decided early on that aged African Americans, these former slaves were in their 80s and 90s by this time, mm-hmm. would be much more likely to talk to African Americans than they would to a white man from the government.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And so there was a separate office called the Negro Unit, which was housed at the Clara White Mission. We would so like to know whether there are any children or even there could be still people in their 80s, and I mean in their 90s, that were a part of that, just as Stetson was. So what distinguished Florida was that among the states in the South, we were the only state that sent African Americans out to interview the former slaves. So
why were we the only state to do that?
Because we were the only office that decided to.
Was that because of Stetson Kennedy's influence?
I can't say that because I don't know. I know how much activity he had in the gathering of the folklore, but how much he really had to say, when I asked him directly that same question, he said, we decided, and I'm thinking, does that include you in that we?
That's fascinating. And Tangela, as Sandra said, this will be the first time that these words will be performed on a stage. That's pretty powerful.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think the most important thing is that we're telling a story in a different way. And it was so funny when I first heard his words or heard his story, I didn't know him. And I asked other people who I felt that should have known him, have you ever heard of Stetson Kennedy? And some people did, some people didn't. But that lets you know that there is a need to spread that type of history.
Yeah, Daryl Willey, not everyone, as influential as Stetson Kennedy was, not everyone realizes that he was the first writer to expose the Ku Klux Klan.
Right,
his book, The Klan Unmasked, was a sea change across the country.
Definitely.
Back in the 40s.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the things that's so powerful about being able to see these words come to life is that we're going to expose a whole community of people to his works.
So a special treat now because we have a preview of this weekend's Reader's Theater performance here in studio. Daryl and Tangela will both do a reading for us. And what are we going to be hearing?
One of the themes is Escape from Slavery, and Daryl will be reading one of the ex-slaves excerpts from William Sherman.
All right, here they are, Daryl Willey and Tangela Floyd.
My name's William Sherman. I was born June 18, 1848, on a plantation near Robertsville, South Carolina. Right now, I live about 12 miles from Jacksonville in Chaseville. Now, one time, one of Master Stokes' slaves ran away. He sent the Negro dogs to catch him. Negro dogs was dogs that went after them runaway slaves. Now, this slave had a head start on the dogs trailing him. Now, he hid around some floating logs in a large pond. The dogs trailed him straight to the pond and start howling, which means they's getting closer to his prey. But they disappeared. Next they seen them was they dead bodies floating up on the water of that pond. They had been killed by that slave. Now, there's about 50 full bloodhounds used to hunt them escaped slaves. That slave escaped and was never seen again. I just don't understand how that slave could stand the icy waters of that pond. But evidently, he made it. Thank
you. So that's the part of, that's one of the excerpts from Escape from Slavery. Another section is Emancipation, and I'll do that with Daryl. My name's Mary Modest Biddle. I was born in 1833 in Pensacola, Florida, and raised in Columbia County, Lake City. Today's eyes lives in Eatonville, Florida. The greatest event in the life of a slave and the most sorrowful in the life of a master was about to happen. My pappy told me, Mary, freedom's at hand. We saw a Negro coming in the distance mounted on a mule. He went to Master Jameson, who stood on the porch, and the traveler told Master about the liberation of the slaves. Boy, Master Jameson had never before been heard to curse. But this was one day he let go some words that are unworthy to repeat. Then he broke down and cried like a slave who was being lashed by his cruel master.
I ain't got no more to do with you. You're free. If you want to stay with me, you can. I'll give you 1/3 of what you raise.
So my mammas and pappas decided to stay, but when the crop was harvested, master didn't do what he promised. He didn't give us nothing. So I slipped away on a mule and galloped to Newmansville. I told one of them Union captains what Master did, and that Union captain gave me a letter from Mr. Jameson saying,
if you don't give Mary's family what you promised, I'm going to put you in jail.
Almost immediately, old Master did just what those orders told him to do. After that, me and my family left Master Jameson to live somewhere else.
Very nice. Sandra, pretty incredible. And that's just a small little piece of what will be performed, right?
Yes, in this performance. But the Reader's Theater has additional series coming up, which are even more interesting. I'm going to let Aunt Tangela tell you about
what's those. Coming up after this weekend.
Okay, so we still have a series that we're doing with the library and also doing the One Spark Week. We're not actually on One Spark, but we're doing that week. We will have an event at the main library. And then we also have a second series called The Black Superheroes that will look at the folklore of the superheroes of ex-slaves. And then lastly, we'll do a Legacy Part 3, The Man in the Mirror, that'll really look at Stetson Kennedy's legacy.
That's incredible. There's so much material. Daryl Willie Kennedy was a prolific writer.
Oh, yeah. And him writing plus the stories of those slaves, I mean, it's powerful. Just to see those voices come alive now.
And Sandra, you've tirelessly worked to make sure that the legacy of your late husband is honored and remembered, not just in our area, but around the world.
Yes, but frankly, it takes folks like these who see the richness and the power of the stories that he and Zora and others collected that really make this come alive for people.
And I would think, too, Tangela, it's especially fitting that this is being done at the Ritz Theater. The Ritz has such a storied history in this town, and it's really seeing a renaissance lately, which is nice and exciting to see.
Absolutely, and I really want to thank Tony Hill and the director of the SMG for really getting us at the Ritz Theater this year.
And let me ask you both, how did you both become part of the performing, the performers? Will you both be on stage on the 7th?
Yes.
Sure will.
How did you guys get involved?
Well, Emmanuel Washington, one of our directors, he called in Daryl Willie, and of course, all I had to do was listen to him one time, and he was just awesome. So that's how he got there. And the first time Emmanuel actually brought Reader's Theater to me, I just knew when I first heard it that this is something that I wanted to do.
What's it like emotionally to say these words and perform them on stage as you've been going through the rehearsal process?
Yeah, it's great. I mean, as an educator, it's one of those things where you can see words on a piece of paper, but to see them come alive and see people speak them is just so amazing. So to have this opportunity, I just feel honored to be able to read these words every day.
And absolutely. Sandra, I'm sure you'll be feeling, there'll be an emotional arc for you, too, to see this happening on stage.
Certainly. As I said in the beginning, you know, I wish Stetson could have lived to see this performance. But I'm just so grateful to the Ritz and to the people in Jacksonville that they're making this available.
It is a special treat. It's coming up on February 7th, Saturday at noon at the Ritz Theater on Davis Street in downtown Jacksonville. Stetson Kennedy Legacy Part 1, Slave and Civil Rights Narratives, a Reader's Theater Performance. Mark your calendar. Going to be a special day. Thank you, all three of you, so much for joining us with this preview. It's been great.
Thank you.
Thanks, Melissa.
And we were joined by Sandra Parks Kennedy, Daryl Willey, and Tangela Floyd, all coming into the studio today for this preview performance. And that's our show. Thanks so much for tuning in. Thanks to all of our guests and callers as well. This show's producer is Sean Birch. The show's theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra's Pyotr Chevchik. If you've got any feedback about First Coast Connect, we always want to hear it. Just send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch our daily podcasts. They're now up on iTunes. Next on Diane Rehm, negotiators from 12 countries are hammering out details of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. A look at what's inside the TPP, prospects for getting the deal through Congress, and what it could mean for the U.S. economy. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow as we're joined by Jacksonville mayoral candidate Bill Bishop. That's tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.